Welcome to the podcast series Us and Them, brought to you by Heidelberg University's Graduate School for Humanities and Social Sciences.
Tune in for thought-provoking interviews with experts in different fields, from the social sciences to the humanities, from law to economics.
HGGS, Us and Them.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our new episode of our HGGS podcast, Us and Them. Today, we have a very special guest, Isabella Gomez O'Keefe, who was a presenter at our HGGS Summer Forum 2025. Welcome, Isabella. We're so happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Isabella, you are a PhD student in sociology at the University of Cambridge. You did your master's in political sociology also at Cambridge, and your bachelor's degree in international affairs from the University of Georgia. And you've also worked with the U.S. State Department and the Center for Information Resilience. That is a quite impressive CV.
Thank you.
One question. Are you in any way related to Georgia O'Keeffe?
I'm not, or at least not that I know of. I have wondered, but the spelling's slightly different, so I don't think so, sadly.
All right. I had to think of her because you studied in Georgia, and yeah. The last name is her. That was so funny.
Our teacher loved that growing up.
That'd be so cool, yeah. So your current PhD project analyzes the sociocognitive framing of enemy images in American political discourse, and it builds on the findings of your past research. Mm-hmm. And you look at the use of these tactics in the US and other global contexts. And then your presentation at the forum focused on the United States and the domestic enemies. Mm-hmm. How did you get the idea to focus on this specific topic?
Ooh, that's an interesting one. It kind of was a slow development. So back when I was at UGA, I was studying international relations, and I actually was focusing on the Middle East and MENA. That's what I was doing when I was at the State Department as well. Mm-hmm. And specifically looking at like terrorism and genocide studies.
Oh, wow.
And the framing of that. And I looked at the Islamic State and the genocide against the Yazidi people. And that's where I kind of got introduced to the theory of enemy images and the framing kind of tactics that were used. And then while that was going on simultaneously, Donald Trump was in power and the January 6th insurrection happened. And I started to see a lot of commonalities in the way the speech I was looking at in these very extreme moments of violence and like terrorism and genocide with kind of some of the rhetoric that was coming out from the current administration and other right-wing influencers. And I was really interested in understanding, I guess, how that theoretical framework could be applied to domestic American politics. And I think when I first started, like, there was moments where people were doubtful that, like, oh, this won't lead to collective action or violence. Mm-hmm. And then when the insurrection happened, I was kind of like, wow, yeah, this is what it's erupted into. Yeah, and then from there was a lot to research, and I really, yeah, became passionate about the topic, and I've kind of stuck with it. Yeah.
Yeah, you already mentioned the storming of the Capitol. That was a huge shock to the entire world. Mm-hmm. But in a way, it's amazing how it also inspired you to delve deeper into this topic.
Yeah.
So it did have at least some positive effect. So what I wanted to ask you, because yesterday you mentioned that you conducted multiple interviews with different people, mm-hmm. and that 80% of the people you interviewed said that the United States has domestic enemies. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask you more about these people you interviewed, like who were they? How did you choose who you wanted to do an interview with? Mm-hmm. And how many people were actually your interview partners?
I need to think of the actual number. So the survey, that comes actually from my survey response. So from the survey responses, I got like 180 responses, I think. And then I did about 35 interviews total so far. Mm-hmm. And I actually originally wasn't planning on doing interviews and surveys. I originally was just going to do social media data. And then my supervisor said that he thought it would be a good idea to kind of use the interviews and surveys and talking to people to kind of better understand where the focus was, because it did feel at first like once Trump was elected again, it felt like interviews were kind of scattered or enemies were scattered everywhere. It was mm-hmm. really hard to understand, kind of narrow it down, because it was there was a lot, and it was a bit fragmented. And so then, yeah, I actually just did a public call through my social media and through LinkedIn. That was the first place I went, and that got a lot of responses. Particularly, there was a lot of people on the left that wanted to be involved, but to my surprise, a lot of people on the right as well.
Really?
But there was definitely a preference from people on the right for the survey responses because those were anonymized. I felt like there was, it was tough to get interview respondents who were on the right who were willing to talk about their opinions openly in the interview. And I actually even felt like some of the people when I did talk to them who were like kind of held back a bit on their opinions because there was almost like a bit more nervousness as like me of what I would think of them as the interviewee. Whereas with the survey, people, I was very surprised at the unfiltered responses I got. And then a couple places that I specifically went to, I also emailed some Republican associations at universities and stuff. I didn't get as much feedback from them, but some got back to me. They sent it also out to University of Georgia's like ambassadorship program. So that helped. A lot of word of mouth. I have a lot of friends because I studied international affairs. A lot of my friends are in D.C., so they just sent it to people. Some people working in politics, some people like, I think somehow it got through to some people like Republican politicians, maybe?
Like local politicians?
I'm not quite sure. My friends in D.C. sent it to like some people and were like, yeah, we sent it to some people working in politics in the Republican side. And then the other thing that was really helpful is I actually went to an evangelical Christian high school, even though I'm not evangelical Christian. So I called one of the teachers that I still have like contact with, who's one of the head teachers at the school. He's like not the principal, but like the assistant principal maybe. And he sent it to all the teachers and that helped a lot. And that was really interesting because I think a massive part of the kind of Trump movement and even the enemies that are happening, it's a lot like grounded in evangelical Christian faith, especially in the South. So that really helped. And that religion gave me a whole new aspect to look at.
I see. Actually, that was also one of the questions you got yesterday. I just remembered the connection between being Republican, being a Trump supporter, and being Christian. And then basically saying, oh, everything that's not Trump, everything that's not MAGA is like against Jesus or something. I thought that was super interesting.
I know, it's super fascinating. There's even like a there's a pastor in like where I grew up who runs one of those big mega churches, like big evangelical mega church, and he had like a lot of pushback and flack, and people were going after him actually and saying he wasn't a Christian. They even like published something about him because he held a conference for parents of gay and transgender youth and how to like how to help them and how to I don't know, include them in the church. And people literally were so upset, and I think it just goes to show like how deep these like kind of enemy images are entrenched also in the church, that they were calling that he should be like excommunicated and, you know, all those things.
I mean, there's also this whole thing of books about being transgender, or books that just point to something like gender existing being forbidden in schools and things like that, right?
That was also one of my favorite parts, is I recently just went back to the school that I was talking about and interviewed the educators. And it's really interesting to me to see, like, it's not a main part of my research, but I was very interested to see how enemy images kind of make their way into education systems and how we talk about education. I think there's a lot of debate also about DEI and critical race theory and that sort of stuff in school. And they even told me when I was there that they had an initiative to bring in more people of color into the school, and that there were parents who left the school because they said it was anti-Christian.
Oh my God, no.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
But I was actually surprised when you said that some people who are more on the political right were ready to be interviewed by you or fill out this survey, because I feel like there is this general hostility nowadays towards academia. And did you get any like hostile replies in the surveys? Like, were people attacking your research in any way?
So, yeah, some people did, or like some people were a bit hostile, or they would like to technically say like academia, or interview respondents will be like, I know you don't agree with this, but this is what I think, sort of like in their answers. But I will say for the most part, like, I was surprised. I think the fact I got ghosted by a lot of the Republican associations that I reached out to, I was not surprised by that, but that was difficult. Some people, like one of my sister's friends told her that she like lied about her race on the survey because she didn't want to be traced back to her responses. Yeah. And I think I will say, like, I spent a lot of time on the internet and on social media in these, like, very far right, you know, circles. And I read a lot. And I expected that the survey responses would be much more sanitized. And to my surprise, they were not. The enemy images and, like, how people were talking about certain things and describing certain things were just as extreme. And
wow.
That was surprising to me because a lot of the people knew me or knew someone in my circle, and yeah, they still were willing to open up. But yeah.
Right. I mean, it's kind of a parallel to here. Like, so many people are willing to openly admit, yeah, I voted for AFD, I voted for a right-wing party in the last election. It's, I don't know, people just don't really feel ashamed about this, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. There was, like, I even had an interview with somebody who I would characterize, I mean, they self-characterize as believing in, like, QAnon and those sort of conspiracy theories. And I found it so interesting the way they were, like, almost trying to teach me, like, give me resources and stuff, which is unique. Yeah, very interesting.
So in your presentation yesterday, which, by the way, I loved,
you
showed us some profiles of alt-right influencers. And I was wondering, first of all, could you maybe give us some examples, like some of the most famous names that people might already know?
Mm-hmm.
And then could you say if there are some general tendencies that all of these profiles have? Like, what do they post about? And what is their consensus on what they call domestic enemies?
Okay, cool. This is a good one, and I'm hoping I can think. So I have them kind of, I have all my influencers sort of characterized in different ways. So, like, there's people like, obviously, like Donald Trump, who's like a politician who's out there a lot, and like Elon Musk. And then I think you have like your high ranking or high profile influencers. So for those, I would say like Charlie Kirk, Laura Ingraham, Jesse Waters, Tucker Carlson. I'm forgetting it. Oh, Ben Shapiro, The Daily Wire.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have like sort of smaller scale ones. I know there's the girl, her name is Riley Gaines, who's making a lot of prominence right now. Pearl something, who is quite interesting because she's specifically like anti-feminist in the alt-right. So you have like different kind of variations where there's some that like Brett Cooper, I think, is more like religious like connotation. Oh, Candace Owens. So you see, like, there's kind of different levels. A lot of them, a lot of the smaller scale ones, have associations with either The Daily Wire or Turning Point USA or the Heritage Foundation. Those are, and I'm trying to think, PragerU is another one. So, like, all they usually will be, like, ambassadors for these bigger organizations and that kind of either before or after their profiles. And then you also have ones that I would say don't characterize as right-wing influencers, but sometimes end up leading to that kind of pathway. So
I see.
I'm trying to think of Joe Rogan as a prominent example of where, you know, he doesn't self-characterize like that. And I think actually in my research, I talk a lot about, I try to stay away from ideological characterizations of the influencers themselves, because I know that it's more about how their audiences receive that. And then, oh, you asked about how they all, the similarities of how they characterize enemies. I'd say, well, the biggest thing is I find it really interesting that a lot of them use like big text. So if you go to their TikTok profile, you'll have like I showed yesterday, it was like dangerously radical and big text. It's like, this is the thing that you're going to take away from.
Scandalous headlines.
Yeah. And then they all have like the same kind of pattern of framing the enemy. So I would say it's definitely always the same kind of enemies I discussed in my research yesterday. So immigrants are commonly talked about, anyone considered to be woke, so racial justice, feminist, that sort of thing, politicians, protesters, and then the last one I always forget, and then people, anyone involved in the knowledge production, so academia, media, like young educators are all kind of demonized, and these are kind of the main targets. And then you see identification. And then that's identifying individuals with the groups, and also collaboration. That's a huge one. So like saying, oh, they're all collaborating
that
together.
That would have actually been my next question, because that was super interesting.
And then demonization. So like you have like the normal demon, like negative connotations of like always unflattering photos. So like if you have radically dangerous, the picture is going to be an unflattering photo of Kamala Harris. And it's, you know, that's like little negative ways. But then it kind of goes into more extreme. I think probably the two worst, maybe three worst is that I see that are the most like harmful are dehumanization. moral exclusion, so like saying that they're immoral, and that links to the Christianity thing. And then the last one is delegitimization, so that also is like using historical terms that like immediately bring up something. So if you call someone a communist, it's immediately bringing back this historical view that the US has about communism. Or if you call people, if you call a protester a terrorist.
Oh, I see.
You know, and then I think the interesting thing is you often see the framing that all of these influencers use almost verbatim reproduced in the comment sections. Mm-hmm. Or like when I use my algorithm, I have a right-wing phone. When I pull it up, like small-scale influencers or small, even just people who are just making a video from their house who don't really have a following, using the same sort of argumentation, the same sort of language. Like Demon Rats, for example, was used across the board on like literally everything I observed for my work and also for my PhD. Like I saw it both ways.
Wow. So when you talk about the claim that all of these enemies collaborate with each other, mm-hmm. I was wondering about this. So is it basically like the far-right influencers saying, okay, woke people, the political mm-hmm. left, the immigrants, mm-hmm. academia, they're all in this together to cause the downfall of our civilization? Because that sounds like a really bad conspiracy theory that many, many people fall for, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say so. It's like, I'm trying to think. A good one maybe is like the immigration thing. So like so much goes into framing immigrants as criminals and violent, and, you know, trying to steal American citizenship, great replacement. That is like there's a lot that just focuses on that. However, we saw with the election coming up, or like when the election was happening, they said, well, Kamala Harris, she conspired to let all these immigrants in, and she conspired to do it so that they could come in and vote illegally and steal the election. They're collaborating together, mm-hmm. and she wants them to like take over. And I think that's a big part of the Great Replacement, which you kind of see echoed a lot in the immigration narrative, is like, oh, actually all these elites are conspiring to overtake the white majority sort of thing. So I think that's kind of how it works. There's times where it is focused just on one, especially if you have like a critical juncture or something happens, like with the murder of that girl, like in Riley, like that's a critical mm-hmm. juncture, then that's just going to be focused on that. But then it kind of is used like pretty quickly after to villainize other enemies. So yeah, like the Democrats, or even now, we're seeing it in California. The protesters are now being villainized alongside the immigrants. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of that transition. Same with Black Lives Matter. Like you hear references to Black Lives Matter all the time when people talk about Democrats, because they're like, well, you know, the way we framed Black Lives Matter as enemies, we're now going to use that in collaboration and how we're going to frame Democrats as enemies and that sort of thing.
Mm. Yeah, I remember that, definitely. Mm-hmm. So something I wondered is how is the United States actually different from other countries when it comes to defining itself against this domestic enemy? Because I feel like we can see the same tendencies in most Western countries, most European countries now, that we have a political shift to the right or even far right. And I would say if you ask Germans, for example, there would also be many people who would say, yes, we do have domestic enemies. Mm-hmm. And so I wondered, first of all, is it more extreme in the United States? And then the second question I thought of, since my research also focuses on the war on terror in film, and so one aspect of that is also othering of Middle Eastern people in film. Mm-hmm. And so there has always been this image of the other against which the U.S. has kind of defined itself, right? Because mm-hmm. at first, when it became an actual state, it was like, we're not like Europeans.
Yeah.
It's them and we're Americans. And then later it was the Soviets and it was Middle Eastern terrorists. Now it seems to be the domestic enemy. So would you say that this is like a continuation of this trend? And is that what differentiates the U.S. from other countries when it comes to this political shift and setting yourself apart from the domestic enemy?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I definitely do think we see it a lot in different contexts. I mean, even in Germany, like looking back historically with World War II, like I think you could understand that as using enemy images then and now with immigration, anti-immigration here. I think the U.S. is unique in a couple of ways. I think its scale and its size is one way, because I think within mm-hmm. nationalism, one of the big issues is trying to connect people. And it, like, United States culture is very individualist. It's very, you know, about the individual. Even just, we talked about public transport earlier. And even just with public transport, it's isolating. It's keeping people separate from one another. And so it's difficult to create that sense of community. And it's also very, you know, multiracial country, multi-ethnic. So again, there's like not such an inherent culture that links everyone together. And I think that's why the U.S. kind of has relied on it historically. I would say it's a continuation of the enemy images. I mean, if we look at the Cold War, yes, there was an external enemy, mm-hmm. but there was also an internal enemy of the Red Scare and going after academics and media. Right. And with the War on Terror, it's the same thing. Just it was you know, the other abroad and the terrorist abroad, but it was also a lot of rise in Islamophobia, going against academics who spoke out, going against protesters, anti-war protesters. So I don't think it's necessarily new. I think it's kind of something that's been culturally ingrained a bit and linked to a lot of different elements. Also, I think like linked to American exceptionalism a bit. But I think that then, I think maybe because of that, those factors, there's more, maybe more extreme uses of it, more extreme focus on it. And I think the media also has like impacted to kind of this new characterization of it as well.
I see. Especially with media like TikTok, where you can get, I don't know, 20 million views on your video very quickly if it goes viral, if the algorithm thinks it's worthy of going viral.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I mean, if we think about the War on Terror is a great example because it really showed how the media sensationalized these enemy images to kind of get viewership and keep viewership. So they had economic incentives. And when we think about that, that was before social media for the most part. And like now with social media, it's even more economically incentivized. It's even more quick. It's even, you need to have, gather that attention even more. Mm-hmm. And all of those factors have just been heightened. So I think it really has led to a space where it can be, yeah, on overdrive a bit. And we see, I mean, I think it's interesting because the influencer that I had in my presentation yesterday, Jesse Waters, that's a traditional media actor who's now using social media as a tool. He's a Fox News anchor and he's getting millions like of views and likes and every time he posts something. And yeah, it's like a new sphere that they're bringing it into. These actors are changing and they're adapting.
And I think for many people, especially younger people, social media is like the source where they get informed about what's happening in the world, right? Like they don't read the newspapers. They go on TikTok, I assume.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So we already briefly talked about how the Capitol was stormed and people saying that the election that Joe Biden won was fake. And so I just wondered, is social media dangerous, or does it make these narratives more dangerous in your opinion because it spreads them quicker and so maybe more people will see this and hear this? And does it also contribute to this increasing isolation of people more, that you're just in your bubble, you see what the algorithm wants to show you, and so maybe you're also less open to other points of view? Would you say that that's the case?
I think yes and no. I think like from the process of like what we are seeing, it is very dangerous. It has heightened the danger. I think, like you said, like the isolationist also, because it's making these online communities that feel so real to people. And it's, you know, I think that's a huge part. A lot of like enemy image theory focuses on the portrayal of the other, but another massive part of my research is also, in order to effectively portray the other in a way that's going to mobilize people, you also have to have a really strong like collective identity that's being framed and in-group alliances. And I think that is one of the things that we've seen on my, you know, even from my little my far right TikTok that I have account, like I can see it. I can see these echo chambers and these bubbles, and you can see people start to go a bit more extreme. I think more sensationalized, people are reacting with emotions. And so definitely there's a lot of danger to it. But I will say on the flip side of that, I think it also has the potential for a lot of good. I mean, we see, you know, positive mobilization from social media too. It allows people to kind of challenge what they're being told by, you know, leadership and the media and politicians, like with protest movements like Black Lives Matter.
I just thought of that one too, yeah.
Black Lives Matter, the Palestine movement recently, also more recently in California, like all, like it's helping people organize and actually have a way of resistance. And I do find that really good. And you see people also, you know, debunking or breaking down enemy images as well, and moving across borders and educating themselves. So I think it's kind of a simultaneous thing. I'm not quite sure what the solution is, but yeah, I think yes and no.
Something I also find really interesting in general is, I can talk about the German example of the AfD again. They have more viewers on social media than all of the other German parties combined, because apparently their content is attractive to younger people especially. And then in the last election, most women under, I think, 29 voted for, like, the left-wing parties. And then most men in this age group voted for AfD. And then I wondered, do influencers, and maybe you also included him, Andrew Tate. do they play a huge role in this? And also, do you think this anti-feminism manosphere movement that we see right now with people like Andrew Tate, does that also contribute to these domestic enemy images we see right now? And are women becoming an enemy image?
Yes, and women are like a really interesting one. I think I mentioned this briefly yesterday, but there's like a weird thing of women have become an enemy image, particularly feminist women and women who don't want to have children, academic women, women, you know, professional women. These are all things. And I think I'm trying to make sure I don't forget all the the question. But like a lot of the way that they're framed by these influencers is like this death of the family sort of thing. And I think influencers, if I had to try to summarize the narrative, it's this narrative of victimhood and you're being denied it. So if you can't, you know, get a beautiful girlfriend and you can't get a high paying job and, you know, you can't start a family, you don't have all these things that you were promised kind of from the American dream perspective. Well, it's because of these feminist women and it's because of these immigrants taking your jobs and it's because of the Democrats hiking up prices on things and that sort of thing. And they're being kind of sold this, it's everyone's fault and you're a victim and this is why you're not getting this thing. Because I think that's another cultural part of the U.S. that's used a lot in these narratives is the American dream of like, you can achieve anything and you should be able to have a white picket fence and a family with five kids and a high paying job. And yeah, and the, so I think that is, I think it is a big part. And I think that's what I considered under the woke enemy. It's, I have like kind of different groups that I'm looking at. So I think like people of color are being presented as enemies. That's why you're seeing all this anti-DEI, but women for sure. And like feminism, it's a huge part. I mean, Charlie Kirk, the one of the influencers I just talked about, just went on and to Cambridge, actually, to the Cambridge Union, was debating a girl there. And he was saying that women are more unhappy because of feminism and that they would be happier if they're in the home. And, you know, a lot of his supporters see that and they replicate that. And we're actually seeing like a really interesting spin-off of like little like men who are trying to become like Andrew Tate. Like I actually know somebody from my school who started a sort of manosphere podcast.
Really? Wow.
Where he interviews other people I went to school with, and it's becoming like a trend actually of the reproduction of this content.
Wow.
Especially to refill the void. And yeah, also even after the election, I don't know if you, Nick Fuentes is another big influencer in the space, and he made a hashtag go trending that was a your body, my choice, right after the election. So
it's absolutely terrible.
Yeah, it's definitely a big part of it. Yeah.
Wow. So I think it was Australia who wants to ban social media for teenagers under the age of 16. And I've been wondering whether this is a good idea or not. In your opinion, does it make sense? Would it avoid or would it stop people from gravitating more towards these far-right influencers, or is it just not a solution to this problem at all?
My gut instinct is no, because I do think, I don't think it's the right solution, because I do think that social media, like I said, can be used for critical thinking. And I think it's all these issues there, I think there's other ways to address them. I think like more in like education, early education, teaching equality, you know, intervention when you see people like having these kind of tendencies or falling into these pipelines through like psychologists and educators. I think it's more about like fixing the social issues that are contributing, I guess, rather than like just the social media companies. Although I do kind of see both sides of it as well. It is concerning about, how young kids are getting access to this. And
I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it would be too easy to just like demonize social media and be like, yeah, this is all bad and nobody should use it.
Yeah. Whereas it's kind of, When I think from the opposite perspective of like critical thinking, you know, education, at least in the US context, sometimes is not showing the complete story of certain things, and it's not helping, you know, teach empathy sort of towards like certain minority groups. You know, it's not really showing the history of all the oppression and horrors they faced. And I think on social media, there are spaces where there are like education to that and offering more opinions. So I would like to think that it could actually be a tool, but I'm not sure.
Sounds great, though. Last question that I wanted to ask you about your academic journey. So I don't know if you already know if you want to stay in academia or not, but I just wanted to ask you, do you already have any idea about what might be other research interests for you? What might be projects that you would like to focus on later? Or would you like to stay in this field and just continue doing more research on this?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely want to stay in academia. I also really prefer probably to stay in European academia. I think right now, I think it's a lot safer. I get more safety and freedom of expression here. But I think I want to definitely continue with this one for a while. There's a lot of data, and even my thesis is going to feel small compared to what there is. Like, I would love to maybe write a book about this topic and keep exploring it. And then I'd like to also look into sub kind of topics and in more detail. One thing that I've like been desperate to research in the future is I'm Cuban, and I really want to do like an ethnographic study on like the kind of far right support in the Cuban community. But yeah, I think like I'd also love to take it to different contexts as well. Like, I'd love to, I've been really interested in looking in other European countries about how it might exist there, like Spain, Germany, Italy, you know, post-fascist countries that have like come out of it, and how that residue has happened. And in the UK, definitely, it's definitely relevant. We're seeing moves towards that with, you know, Nigel Farage and reform.
Right.
So I think, yeah, I'd like to, I think my theoretical framework and the kind of sociocognitive framing and social media element of it will be my constant, but I would like to take it to more cases and case studies around.
Super interesting. I would love to read this book. Tell me if it comes out, when it comes out. Yeah, then thank you so much, Isabella, for first of all being our presenter at the forum.
Thank you.
And for being our guest on the podcast. Thank you to everybody who listened to this episode. And yeah, we'll hope that you will listen to the next one as well. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the HGGS podcast series, Us and Them.
In this series, we bring you conversations with experts from a wide range of disciplines, from the social sciences to the humanities, from law to economics.
If you enjoyed our podcast, we invite you to explore our previous episodes and subscribe to our channel so you never miss a new episode.
Stay tuned for more insightful interviews coming soon.